Should the city of Jacksonville sue pharmaceutical companies over the opioid epidemic? Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can stream us live right now on Facebook, too. Just ahead, why Jacksonville is considering joining a class action lawsuit against the manufacturers of opiates. What do you think about that? Give us a call now, 549-2937. Then later we'll hear how just having a pet can work wonders for Alzheimer's patients. It's all in the new book by local author Michael Bennett in his book, Rusty's War. Plus, Cole Pepper and all the news from Jaguars training camp as the team trains with the Super Bowl champs, the New England Patriots. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, the city of Jacksonville is considering suing prescription drug makers for deceptive marketing. And Jacksonville may join other Florida cities in what could be a class action lawsuit over the opiate crisis, accusing pharmaceutical companies of fueling a deadly epidemic that's killed hundreds of people in the city this year alone and millions around the world. Jacksonville City Councilman and former President Bill Guliford is leading this effort, and he's on the line with more. Councilman Guliford, thanks for joining us. Councilman Guliford, are you with us?
Yep.
Okay, great.
I am.
All right, and here's our question to callers. What do you think about Jacksonville possibly joining other Florida cities in what could be a class action lawsuit aimed directly at the pharmaceutical companies over our cities and this nation's opiate crisis that's killing people every single day? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so, as you've said in the last few days, Councilman, Jacksonville is on track to see some 700 opiate overdose deaths this year alone. Some of these are people that initially start taking legally prescribed pills for pain, and they go on to deadly heroin and fentanyl. How'd you come up with this idea of suing the pharmaceutical companies over this?
Well, the statistics show that back in 2015, 75% of the people that were addicted started off on prescription pills. The pharmaceuticals have sold. First of all, they were deceptive in telling the doctors that this was not addictive. They kept pitching that back some years back. And so, therefore, there was such a widespread use. Now, it has been reduced, but it's still, there's still, last year, there were enough opiate prescriptions to fill a bottle for every adult in the United States. It's still an issue, and I feel like that they are responsible to a great extent of the problem that we have. It's not really we're really not pursuing a class action suit. I've been told by the attorneys that's not the reality of what it would be. It'd be potentially a multi-plaintiff suit. The reason being is that each city or each jurisdiction would have different circumstances and different costs. Mm-hmm. And the foundation of the law is that, or the thought behind it is that they have cost us, the city of Jacksonville, an awful lot of money. Not just the loss of lives, but look at all of the responses, the first responders, the hospital burden, all the things that have been increasingly expensive for the city that we've had to bear because of their irresponsibility.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment on this. Let us know what you think about Jacksonville suing the pharmaceutical companies over the opiate crisis. Councilman Guliford, would there be a precedent legally to look at, and I'm thinking specifically of the landmark tobacco settlements that were brought against big tobacco some 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, you know, that's been raised. That issue's been raised, and the analogy, you know, the similarity of the two is obvious. I think that you're seeing these types of suits initiated both at the state level and county and city level all over the country. So I think there's probably a very good chance that there's going to be a similarity between that and what took place with tobacco, and rightfully so, as far as I'm concerned.
And those hundreds of millions of dollars in settlements went to treat people with smoking-related illness, of course. If Jacksonville were to eventually win some money in this legal action, how would that be used to treat addicts and victims of this crisis?
Well, that's where I would hope a lot of it would be going. I've read a number of articles about this crisis, and it's obvious that there's just not enough money being flowing to addressing the problem. Look, we are not going to enforce our way out of this. This is just not something where we can look at law enforcement, solve the problem. It ain't going to happen. What we need to do is we need to reduce the demand. We need that. That's the critical part of it. And we also need to treat those that are already addicted. And with those two things in mind, you're talking about a good bit of cost to address that.
And, you know, it's really, I think, for people that haven't seen this up close, it's difficult for them to get their arms around the scope and the intensity of this crisis. As we've reported on this program, our local medical examiner, you know, the local coroner in Duval County, has told us that her office literally cannot keep pace with the number of bodies that are coming into the morgue every single day due to overdose deaths. It's truly horrific.
It surely is. And what's really interesting about that, too, is when you look at the generational back breakdown of that, I think the highest number of overdose incidents in the age group was 40 to 50. And you would expect that it might be younger. What we don't tend to recognize is that this is so widespread. As one first responder said to me, I've been in oceanfront houses, I've been in shacks, and I've been in everything in between responding to this thing. This is not the traditional back alley, under the bridge type of drug issue. This is a drug use issue. This is all over across the full spectrum of our society. And I feel really sorry for those that have, without knowledge, become addicted to this stuff. And it has happened over and over again. That goes back to the irresponsibility of the drug companies. It was all about profit, and they have realized, you know, you're talking about drug companies that have made billions, not millions, but billions of dollars in revenue off of these opiates.
And on the other side of this, it's a complicated issue, Councilman Gollerford. What about folks that really need this medication for chronic pain? How do we deal with this?
Well, you know what? The medical community, if you really do some research on that, you'll find out that opiates are not intended for chronic treatment of chronic, long-term chronic pain. There are other options available. We need to stop. Look, that was convenient, and that was the pharmaceuticals pushing this idea of, oh, this is not addictive, and so therefore long-term treatment of chronic pain is okay with this stuff. And so I think we need to reassess, and that's come up again and again in articles across the country. We need to reassess how we treat that chronic pain. A lot of that came out of those pill mills. That was the easy way to do it. Let's prescribe opiates. So I understand the problem with chronic pain. I surely appreciate that. But that doesn't give an excuse to continue this thing if there are other options.
Let's go to your calls right now. If you're just tuning in, as we speak with Jacksonville City Councilman Bill Gollerford, what do you think about this proposal that Jacksonville would take on the pharmaceutical companies, sue them over this city's opioid epidemic that's killing hundreds each year? Our opiate deaths far outpace homicides in the city by a rate of about 7 to 1. What do you think about all this? The number to join us, 549-2937. Lori is on the west side. Hey, Lori, good morning.
Hi there. May I just preface this real quick?
Yeah.
I think that everybody should go and look up the opiate wars between Britain and China to understand the dynamics. That's when I first learned about opiates. Secondly, much of the opiates today are synthetically made and not made by pharmaceuticals, especially the ones on the street. They're made by black market. Thirdly, addicts are considered criminals, not victims. And fourthly, my question is will these opiate suits be contingency suits, or are the taxpayers going to have to foot the bill?
All right, thanks.
Because, quite frankly, this problem has been made by government.
Okay, thanks, Lori. Yeah, who's going to pay? Yeah, Bill Gollerford, who will pay?
Yeah, It would be at least the one law firm that made a presentation to us. It would be taken on a contingency basis, no cost to the taxpayer, which to me shows a commitment on their part that they feel like that there is a legitimate cause of action and that it could be or would be successful. So on that score, you know, we're not going to ask taxpayers for a dime in pursuing. In fact, our general counsel is currently discussing specifics with them to come back to the council and give a report on what their observations, what they think. She makes a very valid point, if you know anything about history, with respect to the British and opiates in China, and particularly in Hong Kong. They used that as a weapon, and it totally destroyed Chinese society for some years. And that's what really worries me about this thing is I think it's not just about suing pharmaceuticals. I think it's about enforcement. I think it's about education. I think it's about treatment. And if we can recover money from pharmaceuticals to help in those efforts, they started this regardless of, and the young lady's right, there's a lot of synthetics available out there. But again, statistically, the vast majority of addictions started with prescription drugs. That is documented.
Yeah.
So
legally prescribed, sure.
Yeah, legally prescribed drugs, and consequently, when the faucet got shut off, then those people who were addicted looked to other sources, and of course, that was on the street. So, you know, I feel pretty strongly that they started this. They have a financial responsibility to help fix it, to clean it up.
Chuck at the Beaches. Hi, Chuck. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. I'll start out by saying that there's what's called an addictive personality, and then there's also people who have mental issues, and so a lot of people self-medicate. Now, if you take someone, and this happens in hospitals quite a bit, I don't know if you're familiar with what happened at Mayo Clinic, or you're familiar with what happened to the Atlantic Beach police chief. He lost his job over drugs, and doctors and nurses are dealing with this all the time, and, you know, if you're a pharmacist, doctor or a nurse, and you go in and you have an addictive personality and they give you the OxyContin, you could get addicted to it and you could be feeling it. So of the 50,000 people that died in 2015, which is the number one cause of unintentional death in America, 50% of the deaths were from pills. The other half was from on the street. And I had this conversation with a gentleman who worked in a hospital for 30 years, and I said, you know, in 2001, if you had a fifth grade class and you drew on the board of heroin and you drew on the other side of the board, you drew OxyContin. And you said, what will happen if you put OxyContin in every kitchen cabinet in America and OxyContin is the same as heroin? And the fifth graders would say, well, you'd have addiction problems. And then if you said to the fifth graders, what will happen if you make the OxyContin cost more than the heroin? The fifth graders would say they're going to go to heroin. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. The pharmaceutical industry knew what they were doing. And the gentleman I was saying this to, who worked in the hospital for 30 years, he held up his hand and he said one word. He said money. So it happened with the cigarette industry, asbestos. And so it's a terrible problem. And you said something, how people don't know about it. How can you possibly imagine? It's everywhere. How do you not know a family that's dealing with this? Thanks for letting me.
Yeah, thank you, Chuck. Bill Gulliford.
No, he's exactly right. I mean, we've seen people who are pillars of the community that have had family issues that have led to overdose deaths. I don't think people can really appreciate how widespread this is across the spectrum. When you look at a map of that our fire and rescue has put together, locating every single overdose call last year, you will be amazed at how it covers the entire county. It is just it is just absolutely scary.
And when you talk to JFRD too, they talk about this. They've had to really almost revise some of their protocols on how they respond to calls because so much of it is involving this, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and that's another thing that worries me. I've had conversations with the chief and also with the sheriff, and that is when do you burn out your first responders with something like this? When half your calls or responding to overdoses. You know, at what point do you lose compassion, and at what point do you throw up your hands and say, I can't do this anymore? I think that's a legitimate concern, and it's manifesting itself in other jurisdictions already. It's going to be a problem in the future, too. So we can't just keep, that was the idea of this. See, here's what we're doing. We are responding, we are transporting, we are stabilizing in the hospitals, in the emergency rooms, and we're putting them back on the street. They're still in withdrawal, they're still hurting. Guess what they're going to do over and over again? Mm-hmm. So that cycling that we're doing isn't working. That's the reason to try this program, this test program. I think we'll probably end up starting on October 1st. Where St. Vincent's Hospital, their emergency room, will intervene. There will be specialists there, peer recovery specialists, who have been addicted, who have been properly trained, who will intercede with these folks, that will engage these people and offer them a treatment solution. Now, we know that not all of them are going to respond favorably to that, but if we can get half of them, then that will start the recovery process in a meaningful way. And if that works, then the community is going to have to address how do we put it in every emergency room in the city.
Right. And if you're just tuning in this morning, our lines are jammed as we speak about a very hot topic, Jacksonville considering suing Big Pharma over our opiate crisis, an epidemic that's killing hundreds each year in Duval County. Jacksonville City Councilman Bill Gulliford is our guest. Lots of calls for him. Let's go to Mark in Mandarin now. Hey, Mark, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. Some cities will participate in the class action suit and pay the legal fees of discovery, motions, trial, and appeals. And if they win, cities that did not participate will be free riders, as it will then cost much less for them to sue. The cities whose elected officials will most want to incur the expenses of the class action are those where the elected officials want to reward the law firms that contributed most to their election campaigns. As a Jacksonville taxpayer and citizen, I would prefer that Jacksonville not participate in the class action.
Okay.
But
yeah.
Can I address that comment?
Sure.
I think the gentleman's got some facts wrong. Number one, it's not a class action suit. It's a multi-plaintiff suit. It cannot be a class action suit, and therefore we would not participate if we didn't sue. Secondly, it would be taken on a contingency, no out-of-pocket expense for the taxpayers. Thirdly, I don't know of anybody that's received or would receive a political contribution that's on the city council from this particular law firm that's down, and that's actually a national law firm that does have an office down in Boca Raton. And this isn't about politics. I'm not running for office again. This is about a crime, as far as I'm concerned, that our only recourse to these pharmaceuticals is to file suit against them and try and recover some of the cost that our taxpayers have assumed. While that gentleman wants to talk about cost of the taxpayers, is he anywhere cognizant of the millions of dollars we're spending right now in responding to overdoses on the street every single day? The cost of Narcan to bring these people back, that's skyrocketing too. All of these costs are everyday occurrences. When do we stop that?
Ask you, Councilman, how many other cities, municipalities around the country have come to the same conclusion you have and are planning this kind of lawsuit?
Well, I think you're hearing a number of them. City of Delray Beach had a presentation by these folks, and they voted to pursue a legal action subject to the establishment of a case. I think that you're going to see more and more. I know Palm Beach County is looking hard at it. I think you're going to see more and more cities that say that this is not right. We need to go after them, and we need to get some kind of reimbursement for the excessive costs that we're assuming and that they created.
Rachel is in Ocala. Hey, Rachel. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I guess my main question is, with the mental health, a gentleman brought it up, and it kind of brings up a good point. Close to home with, like, okay, you're looking at the age range. So, like, you know, what percentage of, if he knows, of veterans are a part of that demographic of the opiate, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, how many veterans affected? Thanks for that. Do we know that, Bill Guliford?
No, we really don't. But I can tell you, because of the widespread nature of the addiction, you can bet there are a number of veterans that are addicted. And it's surprising when you see some of the people that are addicted. You wouldn't have any idea that they would be. This stuff is so onerous that once you're hooked, and that's going back to a comment that was made earlier, and there was an editorial and letter to the editor in the paper last couple of days criticizing this effort and suggesting that we just round up all these addicted people and throw them in jail. Well, that's a preposterous suggestion. These people are not criminals. These people, and many times, unbeknownst to them, they've become addicted again because of the dadgum irresponsibility of the pharmaceuticals. So the treatment issue is going to be big. We have got to come up with a way to address that, and funding it is going to be very, very expensive.
Lots of calls for you, Bill Guliford, about the opiate crisis all over the listening area. Let's go now to St. John's County. Hey, Rob in St. Augustine, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. How
sure.
are you?
Good.
Good. I got a question regarding the payment of these lawsuits. Let's say that the lawsuits do go through. The pharmaceutical companies will obviously incur legal defense fees. And let's say that the lawsuits are successful and the pharmaceutical companies have to pay out these penalties, where is that money going to come from? Isn't the pharmaceutical company just going to raise the prices on all of their drugs for all of the taxpayers?
Thanks for that, Rob. Go ahead, Bill.
That's probably a question you have to ask pharmaceutical companies, but that's there's a lot of assumption here. I can tell you that I saw a number on I can't remember whether it's oxycodone or OxyContin, but one of the two over a 10-year period of time, I think their revenues from that drug alone had been somewhere in the neighborhood of $38 billion, I believe. They are making an incredible amount of money as far as us being concerned because they might raise the price of drugs. Look, this is going to be a long, drawn-out battle. If you go back and look at the history, you referenced the tobacco cases. That went multi-years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could be looking at 10 years down the road before there was some settlement or there was some court decision. At that
point, and let me just jump in. Does the city have the stomach for that?
Well, I don't think that if we're not involved in the suit itself, I think for sure we have the stomach for that. I mean, in terms of financially involved in the suit, I don't see any reason that would prevent us. I think you got to remember something else, too. I think an action like that has another impact, and that is it's sending a message that we're really serious about this opioid problem that we have. And as I said earlier, it's got to be multifaceted. It's going to take a lot of different approaches, from awareness to treatment to you name it. But I don't think that we should. I think this suit is also part of that. And I believe that we need to take stand. As I said before, we're spending millions of dollars beyond what we would normally spend in reaction to what we're seeing as a crisis.
Let's go to Janet on the West Side now. Hi, Janet. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm really, really thrilled that you're taking this subject on, and I just wanted to offer my opinion that when something like this is killing so many of our citizens, we need to stand up, and it doesn't matter what the cost, and I certainly don't think we should ever consider where the pharmaceutical company is going to find the money to pay off this lawsuit. Again, that can't be a reason for a decision to hold somebody accountable for what they've done. I'm just going to end by saying that one of the dearest friends in my life was a 29-year-old man at 9/11. He was a construction worker six blocks away. He ran to go lend help, and for the next 10, 11 years of his life, he suffered a lot of debilitating illnesses and had become hooked on OxyContin. At the time when it became clear that this was addictive, he was almost labeled a drug addict. They cut him off of his OxyContin, and he ended up on the streets.
and died on his 41st birthday.
Oh, I'm so
this
sorry to hear that.
This does have a real face to really good people who find themselves in very desperate situations.
Yeah, that's right, Janet.
I think her story about that gentleman has been repeated over and over and over again, and my heart goes out to those people and the families and the friends that have witnessed that. I've heard those stories so many times that it's really, and this is that mindset that was suggested in that letter to the editor about criminalizing this thing. You know, apparently this addiction is so strong, it basically takes over a person, not only a person's mind, but their soul. And I just can't condemn that, especially the ones that have by unintentionally become addicted. You know, that's just not right. It's a medical issue as far as I'm concerned.
And some people are more genetically susceptible to getting addicted than others.
Yeah. Sure they are. Look at all the people that have said, you know, that got off cigarettes and how hard it supposedly was. How much stronger is this compared to addiction to cigarettes? I mean, I think that it has to be addressed fairly and give some consideration to this true situation that we're facing.
And Councilman Gulliford, here's a comment from our First Coast Connect Facebook page. CJ writes, "It was the feds that approved the report by manufacturers that opiates weren't addictive. They're really at fault. The same government that classified marijuana as a class one drug worse than opiates, but no one's ever OD'd on marijuana. The lawsuit idea is noble, but the issue is bigger than a local issue and may be too costly. This could last years, if not decades. This should be addressed as a state issue." What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that, and nor am I disagreeing with the fact that, look, if you want to start, let's start pointing fingers, and we can point fingers at a lot of people. We can point fingers at unscrupulous doctors who prescribe this stuff. We can point fingers at ourselves. What do we evaluate a doctor? What do we base our evaluation of a doctor on? Many, many times it's, did you relieve my pain? So there was great pressure on doctors to make sure that people were pain-free. We shifted in the last several generations about how we treated pain and how we were able to withstand or sustain pain as patients. So when we start finger-pointing, we can start at the top with the federal government. We can go right down the line, and we can point at a lot of people. But my response to that is, so what? You play the hand you're dealt, not the hand that you want to be dealt. And the hand we're dealt right now is we need to address this thing. We need to stop talking. We need to take action.
Lots of tweets coming in as we talk about Councilman Gulliford's push to have Jacksonville sue Big Pharma over our city's opiate crisis. Chuck tweets the show, "Instead of lining lawyers' pockets, the money should be invested in local control and response to addiction and recovery." Apparently, that would be the bulk of the funds would go to that. Brian tweets the show, "I hope treatment overtakes arrest. With all epidemic addictions, we need to learn from the drug war and not revive a double standard." Thanks for those tweets, guys. And let's take a few more calls. Mitch is in Ortega this morning. Hey, Mitch, thanks for holding and being so patient. You're on the air now.
Yes. Councilman Gulliford talked about alternatives to pain management and not focusing so much on the opioids. And my question is, what are the alternatives? You know, when you've got the vast majority of people who are taking opioids for chronic pain, which are doing it legally and through their doctors, their pain management doctors, what alternatives do they have?
Sure.
I haven't heard anybody address those.
Thanks for that question. Alternatives for pain.
Well, I read an interesting article that this has been a hot topic in debate. We haven't seen the impact of it yet because it hadn't been implemented, but medical marijuana was one that has been touted as a long-term solution to addressing chronic pain. I've also been told that there are non-opioid drugs that are effective in addressing. I think that this was easy. And consequently, you know, the path of least resistance were the opioids that were being prescribed. But as I said earlier, in reading some of the medical articles I've read, that they're stating that opioids are not the right thing for treating long-term chronic pain. It's happened. It's been done. But that doesn't make it right. So I just don't believe that with what I've read thus far that that's the only option we have, the only viable option to treating long-term chronic pain. It's up to the medical community to come up with solutions and address that situation.
And then finally, Councilman Bill Gulliford, you're waiting a report from the legal experts looking at this. What's the timetable for the city moving forward on this?
Oh, I don't any rush until we feel comfortable. We'd have to take it back to the city council, and of course I've made the mayor and the administration aware of it, and general counsel participated in the meeting that we had. We could see sometime maybe the beginning of the year a lawsuit filed. The law firm gave a basis in Florida law that they would pursue it under, and I think that there's certainly merit. I think the general counsel is evaluating that also. But as I said earlier, in a similar type lawsuit, which tobacco was probably similar, that went out for years. It isn't going. I'm probably not going to see resolution to it, but I would hope that if there is resolution in favor of the city and that there was a substantial gain, then I would hope that that money would go solely to addressing treatment and other particular facets of this chronic or this horrible problem that we have, and not go anywhere else.
Well, we thank you for sharing this critical information with our listeners, and we'll follow it closely. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
He's Jacksonville City Councilman, former Council President Bill Gulliford, on the line with us this morning. Meanwhile, much more still ahead. Later, the Jaguars will hold a combined practice this week with Super Bowl champs, the New England Patriots. Culpepper has details on that and the rest of the week's sports news and notes. But up next, the magic of pets and how they help patients with Alzheimer's. One woman's story right after this.
Congress is advancing a bill to let terminally ill patients try experimental drugs that the FDA has not yet approved. The Right to Try Act passed the Senate, and it has support in the House and with President Trump. Critics say the bill offers false hope. For millions of Americans, hope may be all they have. The Right to Try Act, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
This year marks the 75th anniversary of the Charles Hosmer Morse Museum of American Art in Winter Park. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the Morse Museum, which has the most comprehensive collection of work by Louis Comfort Tiffany anywhere. We'll discuss the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind and environmental history. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, September 16th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 event will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues. Learn new ways to engage students and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues, as part of WJCT's After Hours, tonight at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, it's the moving story of one woman's battle with Alzheimer's disease and how she came to depend on her dog, Rusty, to cope as she went through the early and moderate stages of this dreadful affliction. In the new book, Rusty's War, A Battle of the Mind, Author Michael Gordon Bennett tells the story of his mother's journey through Alzheimer's and how Rusty, her dachshund, helped her cope with it. She's not alone. Research shows the very presence of pets can help reduce the worst effects of dementia and Alzheimer's, alleviating anxiety, irritability, depression, and loneliness. Author Michael Gordon Bennett is on the line now with more. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. We all love our dogs, and so many of us have a loved one with Alzheimer's. So this is a story that so many listeners, I think, will be so interested to hear. Tell us a little bit about your mom and about her dog, Rusty.
Well, my mother was actually diagnosed with Alzheimer's about 4.5 years ago, but something along the way told us that she'd been suffering a lot longer than that time frame. And she actually got Rusty when Rusty was just 8 weeks old. So the timing of when Rusty arrived in her life and probably the timing of the Alzheimer's diagnosis and what we now know to be the pre-stages of that disease kind of coincided with one another, and it was perfect timing. You know, I was living in California away from my mother. My sisters were living away, and no one knew that she was silently suffering until I came home on vacation one day and just noticed right away that something was wrong. And it was Rusty who was her confidant. She relied on that little guy for everything, even to the point when they eventually moved in with me. He would alert me if something was wrong with her. He would come in and sniff my hand or bark at me and tell me to come check on her. So the two of them formed a bond that, honestly, I had to separate them about a month and a half ago, but it hurt to separate them because I saw how close the two of them were, and it just broke my heart.
Why did you have to finally separate them?
My mother's memory has gotten so bad now that she tries to do things for Rusty, like pick him up and move him around and things that she's incapable of doing. And she actually slipped a disc in his back. And, you know, then I wound up spending a bunch of money on vet bills to get him back to health. Now, she has emotionally, she still remembers Rusty, but the idea that he's there all the time in her life every single day, it's not true. Fortunately for me, my sister is renting my mother's house, so I sent Rusty right back to the very house he was, grew up in. So the ability to kind of make things comfortable for both actually worked out very well. But for those first 8 years, the two of them were inseparable.
And how do you think Rusty was able to sense your mother's needs and predicament? I mean, people talk about the therapeutic benefits of pets when somebody's ill, but this is sort of a special bond, a special connection, it sounds like, because she wasn't ill in a way that was physically obvious.
That's true, but one of the things that, you know, most people talk to their pets, I mean, I do too, you know, sometimes the dog's saying you're playful and things like that. But with Alzheimer's patients, they have a tendency to have paranoia and hallucinations. And a lot of times my mother would talk to Rusty as if she were talking to a little doll, like a little girl would talk to her doll and play with the doll. And it was just a hallucination. And somehow or another, and I don't know how intuitive animals are, but Rusty figured out the difference between when she was just talking to him in a normal, playful dog language, if you will, and when she was having these very serious conversations with Rusty. And he kind of looked at her and turned his little head, and he would try to understand, and then he would reach down and lick her hand, knowing that what she was saying would be forgotten 30 seconds later. How he figured that out, I have no clue. Maybe it was the tone of voice, maybe it was just her physical reactions, but Rusty figured it out quite well, and I think it helped that he was around prior to her diagnosis, so he knew the difference.
And how do you see health professionals treating Alzheimer's, looking at your book, Rusty's War, and finding ways to help more patients in terms of animal therapy?
Well, one of the things that I've discovered is, you know, we had an advantage. Rusty was there from the beginning. But a lot of the health professionals and even pet professionals have warned me about Alzheimer's patients. They're saying, if you don't have a dog that, you know, you had prior to the disease, be careful about introducing Alzheimer's patients to animals. Sometimes it helps them therapeutically, like it did with my mother. Other times, because Alzheimer's patients have a lot of fear that comes with the illness, it can turn them off. But so far, my experiences did not just with my mother, but other Alzheimer's patients that I've observed when they brought pets in to interact with them, it's actually worked
very, very well. I don't know what breed of dogs actually generate that feeling of that goodbye for the Alzheimer's patients, but I've seen several Alzheimer's patients who never owned a pet. But when the pet came in to visit them, like in an assisted living center, they were in love. It was beautiful to watch.
Well, it's a fascinating and it's a really touching story. And it's a local author, too, which we love to celebrate. Thanks so much for sharing this with us. We appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
He's author Michael Gordon Bennett. His new book is Rusty's War, A Battle of the Mind. And in a moment, why the Jaguars are practicing with the Patriots. Culpepper is up next.
Trade has been the way of the global economy for much of the past couple of decades, not without some flaws, though.
By focusing on the winners from trade and ignoring the losers, I think we've created the situation that we're in today.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The rise and fall, of globalization. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Judges are confirming what listeners already know. The WJCT News team is among the best in the nation in the state of Florida. This year, WJCT News took home national awards for Best Arts Reporting and Best Talk Show, as well as statewide honors including Best Newscast and Best Continuing Coverage. For excellent journalism, stick with WJCTNews.org and 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your news.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Summertime is learning time. WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Library are partnering to help families fight this summer slide with educational programming and online resources that encourage learning at home. Log on to wjct.org/education/summer to find summer reading lists, activity books, early literacy development tools, and much more. Help your child prepare for the new school year at wjct.org/education/summer.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars will hold combined practices this week with Super Bowl champions, the New England Patriots.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
It's all building up to Thursday night's preseason opener. Cole Pepper's here now with more on how it happened and the rest of the week's sports news and notes. Hey, Cole.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, this is not the first time the Jaguars have held combined practices, but it's the first time they've gone away to do so in quite some time. You have to go back to Tom Coughlin's coaching era to find a time where the Jaguars went away to do some work. And it's interesting to see what has happened here and how it all came to take place. Today, tomorrow, and Wednesday, the Jaguars and Patriots are holding combined practices. They're actually on the field right now in Massachusetts working together. It certainly, a lot of this has to do with Tom Coughlin, who sought out Bill Belichick, the guy he beat twice in Super Bowl, by
right,
the way,
exactly.
I'll point out.
Yeah, yeah.
To do these, because how better to test yourself and to measure yourself than against
the best
team
out
in the NFL?
There.
Right, and particularly for the defense, to be able to work against Tom Brady, who may not play very much in the preseason opener, may not play at all on Thursday, to get these chances to go against the best quarterback in the game certainly is a major plus for the Jaguars. Here's what head coach Doug Marrone had to say about the benefits of working against the Patriots.
None. Zero. I want to go back to the old way. I want to change the game.
All right. Well, that was his
short
earlier
sweet.
Thought. Yeah, about
how
that.
Common is it for teams to do this?
It happens. Not every team does it, and certainly the Jaguars hadn't done it for quite some time. They did do some work with it last year with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who they'll scrimmage with and work with again in advance of their preseason matchup. I would say it's probably about 2/3 of the teams in the NFL in any given year will do that. So that's one of the things that you're seeing more and more of. And what this really points to is that the games, the preseason games, particularly early, first game, sometimes the second, don't offer you as much for your starters as you have benefit-wise for the backups, because the starters don't play as long as the backups do. So you get all those reps in practice against somebody else. You get to bang heads against somebody who's not your teammate. That certainly is a benefit for the Jaguars. Now, I posted a story on the Channel 4 website about the six things I've learned about the Jaguars here in training camp.
Okay.
I'm going to summarize them.
Cole's findings.
Yeah, here's what we've learned. Number one, this is not Gus Bradley's camp. You heard the short and sweet from Doug Marrone there. He's a completely different type of person, usually not short and sweet, by the way, usually more of a storyteller in the way he interacts with the media. He's very old school in the way he goes about his business. He is, instead of trying to take pressure off players, he's trying to put them in pressure situations and see how they respond. 180-degree change from what's been happening previously with Gus Bradley here.
Raising the bar then.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And one of the ways he's doing that is by not handing starting jobs to people without having them earn it. And that's especially true for rookies. Interesting that Cam Robinson, who was in a battle for the starting job with Brandon Albert, is still in a battle for the starting job now with Josh Wells after Albert's sudden retirement, because Doug Marrone doesn't want to give the second round pick the easy path. He wants him to have to work for it. Same thing.
Earning something.
Right. We could make some generational
comments. We could make some generational comments, couldn't we? Fellow Gen Xer.
We probably could. same thing with Leonard Fournette, who is clearly looks the part. Now, the difference is at running back, you can use two or three running backs, and whoever starts the game, not as important as who finishes. But Fournette, Chris Ivory, TJ Yeldon listed as co-starters right now on the Jaguars' first depth chart. Number three, Blake Bortles has created a huge question. He had an awful Saturday night practice a week ago where he threw five interceptions. Mm-hmm. Since then, he's been anywhere between okay and pretty good. But that one practice has brought so many questions, more so when you consider what happened with Bortles last year. This is still the big question about the Jaguars season is how is Blake Bortles going to play, and will he be able to establish himself as a Jaguars franchise quarterback, or are they going to be in the business of looking for a quarterback very
soon? So the heat is on there.
The heat is definitely on. Number four, Leonard Fournette. It's everything you'd expect out of a number four pick. Doesn't act like a rookie. Doesn't run the ball like a rookie. And imagine this, Melissa. He said it got easier when the pads went on.
No way.
I've never heard in 23 years of covering the National Football League, I've never heard a rookie say much better now that the pads are on. Number five, the defense should be very good. The difference between being good and great could be the pass rush. If Dante Fowler can come anywhere near living up to his draft status, and if Yannick Ngakoue can continue to develop, that's going to be a big push. Those two, by the way, whereas last year they would often be lined up on opposite sides, they're battling for the starting for playing time at the same position. So that both are pushing each other this year.
And it's sort of like almost a Game of Thrones, isn't it, at this point in the season where some guys just aren't going to make it.
Yeah, and if somebody rides in on a dragon, there's going to be real trouble to pay. finally, there are going to be some difficult cuts this year, especially on the offensive side of the ball. That's a good sign that the roster is getting better and that there are better bottom-of-the-roster players. But there are going to be some familiar faces who aren't going to make it to the regular season.
All right. Other sports to talk about, soccer and baseball.
Yeah, let's talk about the Armada, who lost at Puerto Rico 1-0 on Saturday. They'll play at North Carolina this Saturday before returning home for a match with Puerto Rico, a rematch a week from Wednesday. We saw the Armada debut of Tony Taylor on Saturday, the former Bishop Kenny and JU star who had played for NYCFC and MLS and had been playing professionally in Portugal, one of the three players who was acquired by new owner Robert Palmer after his acquisition of the team. And Taylor made his debut. Exciting to see a local guy get the start.
Some hometown pride there.
Yep, and the Jumbo Shrimp hit four home runs at a 12-6 win yesterday. They continue a long homestand that runs through next Monday. They'll play all the way through except for Wednesday, which is an off day for the Shrimp.
All right, lots of sports happening. It's almost football season again, which means Cole will be busy and happy because I think you get a little bored when football season goes away like a lot of guys
and
do.
Right now with football and soccer intersecting, there's plenty of work to be done. And Thursday with the preseason opener, we'll finally get a chance to see the Jaguars on the field in a game situation. I'll put game in quotes because it is the preseason. But definitely it's that time of year. There's a lot more energy around.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Download the Sam and Cole Sports Podcast. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us anytime. Next on 1A, why states and federal lawmakers want patients to be able to request access to treatments that haven't been approved for wider use. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.